Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Tamim Ansari, author of The Widow's Husband, West of Kabul, and Destiny Interrupted, World History Through Islamic Eyes. He'll speak on the topic Through Islamic Eyes, A Parallel History of the World. Mr. Ansari's appearance was co-sponsored by the Henry W. Casper S.J. Professorship in History and the Creighton University Muslim Student Association. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday evening, April 8, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is John Calvert, Associate Professor of History at Creighton University.
Tonight's speaker, Tamim Ansari, truly lives the life of the written word. He was born in Afghanistan, but since the mid-1960s, he's lived here in the United States, mostly in the West Coast. He spent time in Portland, currently resides in San Francisco. He's an editor. He's a teacher who directs the venerable San Francisco Writers' Workshop, and he's also an accomplished author. I teach a course in historiography, and I often tell my students that history is the story we tell about ourselves and other people. History is all about perspective. It's viewed and told through lenses. And tonight, Mr. Ansari will talk about world history from a perspective that many of us are not familiar with. So I'll ask Mr. Ansari now to come to the podium. Let's give him a round of applause and welcome him to Creighton.
Thank you, John. Thank you all for being here. Thank you, Creighton University Muslim Students Association, for inviting me, and Dr. Nasir and everybody else who was involved. I'm very happy to be here. I was talking with some history professors outside just a moment ago, and the question came up about the teleological view of world history, a sense of things having happened the way they did because of where they were going to end up. I think there is something to that. I think that the history of the world, whoever tells it, is the story of how we ended up here and now. And all I want to say about that is that, therefore, the history of the world depends on where the here is and who's doing the telling. And this book emerged as an idea for me back just before 9/11, the year before that and into 2001, when I was given an interesting assignment by a publishing company. I worked in textbook publishing then, and usually in textbooks they always take what's there already and mulch it down, add what they think should be added, subtract what people have protested, and this gray sort of shapeless mulch keeps going on from year to year. But this publishing company said, let's just start from the beginning. Let's throw out the whole thing and write a new world history textbook for 10th grade or whatever the grade was. And that was my job, was to conceive of it and develop that book and do it with the help of advisors and the history teachers, State Department officials, and other people like that. And so first of all, I thought that was really interesting because the given was the book is going to be divided into 10 units, each into three chapters. And so go, the history of the world. What's the 10 units? What are the three chapters? And I'm like, oh, that's really interesting. What is, if you were going to divide everything that human beings have done on Earth, what are the 10 stages of that? So I came up with some scheme, and then the advisors came in and everyone said, this is too important and this one has not gotten enough coverage. And I began to realize that there was a certain tug and pull between me and the advisors. There were things that I thought were more important than they thought, and there were other things that they were leaving out. And eventually I traced it down to that, every time something came up about Islam, it was like, well, that's too much for a chapter. Let's make a sidebar on that and put it in this other chapter. And their sense of how important Islam had been in world history was different than mine, and probably because I grew up in Afghanistan and my first introduction to world history was in the schools there, looking out from that point of view. And in the end, we ended up with one chapter on Islam, I think, and it was in the unit with pre-Columbian civilizations and ancient kingdoms of Africa. And so I guess the feeling was that this was an important thing at one time, but it's over now, and it wasn't that important. And in my book, I show a map of the you know what you can legitimately call the Islamic world, and it started in a certain place and grew to a certain size, and it's stayed at roughly that size from then until now, 1,400 years. And it's huge. And so the question is, how could we not have noticed that this huge sort of coherent entity is right over there to the east of where we're living? Then the events of 9/11 happened, and everyone started saying, what's going on? Who are these Muslims? Where do they come from? And I felt like, okay, maybe it's time to look at writing a book that's telling the narrative of world history as it would look if you're anywhere between, let's say, Istanbul and the Indus River. My point of departure is the perception that I have, and I think some people agree with me, that you know there worlds of narrative develop when many societies are in so much interaction with each other that they hear each other's stories, they have things to do with each other, and they're constantly either invading, trading, or in some other way interacting. And in ancient times, the Mediterranean Sea was the easiest way to get from any place to any place else if you lived anywhere near the Mediterranean. That was the busiest highway of world traffic back and forth, and all the different civilizations and societies that were anywhere near the near the Mediterranean came to know of each other. But there was another busy tangle of trade routes and so on that was overland traffic mostly, and it ran from the Mediterranean east towards China and then south into India and then branched up north into the Turkic steppes up there. And those people also, in my view, from growing up in Afghanistan, knew of each other and were in the same larger narrative, or they developed a large shared narrative. And when I say shared narrative, I don't mean that they were all liked each other and they were enemies with the other guys. No, I think what I'm saying is that they were a self-enclosed world. Both their enemies and their friends were in that world, and everything that seemed to matter was in that world, and everything outside was relatively less noticed. So to me, there have been these two coherent worlds. There are other ones too, of course. There's the Chinese world, there's the Indian world of Indian civilization. But there's this one area that I've called the middle world, which usually hasn't been accorded recognition as a place in itself. And this place that we live in is Western civilization, but I'm saying there's another coherent world that is between Western civilization and Chinese civilization. That's why I call it the middle world. A part of that world is usually called the Middle East. And all I want to say is if you're where I came from, that's the Far West. So, you know, even the labels is a matter of where you're standing. You know, when we look at world history as we usually experience it here, we see it as having started, civilization started in Egypt and Mesopotamia, and then it came up through Greece and Rome, and then there was the Dark Ages, and then civilization recovered, and there was the Renaissance, Reformation, you know, scientific and industrial revolutions, and on into modern times. And what I want to say is that, you know, in that way that was represented by a New Yorker cover cartoon where they showed the map of America as seen from New York, and half of the map gets you to 57th Street and half of the remaining gets you to White Plains and then Kansas, California, everything, little tiny sliver far away. In that sense, if, you know, the things that are far seem less important, the things that are closer seem loom large, I say that in that middle world, many of the events of the Western-centered world history are relatively minor and not noticed. And there's a different set of stages that you would divide all of history in if you were over there. That coherent world existed, and so when Islam was born in the Arabian Peninsula, it wasn't just a matter of conquest. It was also a matter of people who were interacting with each other quickly heard about and had some reaction to Islam, and it spread quickly throughout this middle world. It went, you know, like a prairie fire from the Arabian part of the world across Iran, across Afghanistan, down into northern India and up into the Turkish steppes. And what I want to tell in this book, and I, you know, when I'm done speaking, you guys can go buy it outside. Is that true? They can buy it outside. What I want to tell is that the founding myth of Islamic history is the experience of Prophet Muhammad and the community he built in the Arabian Peninsula in the 7th century, a time when there were two superpowers in the world, and one was the Iranian Sassanid Empire, and the other was the remnants of the Roman Empire, which, looking back, we now call the Byzantine Empire. And in the desert where the Arabs lived, the Bedouins had this nomadic lifestyle, but along the coast, some busy little commercial cities had built up, and that's where Muhammad was born. Maybe many people there, one or two generations removed from Bedouin life, but they were urban folks. And, you know, the story that all of us Muslims are familiar with is that Muhammad was born as an orphan. He was, you know, sort of kicked around a lot in his younger days. He was the forgotten guy in a small, in one of the poor clans of one of the big tribes in Mecca. And in Mecca at that time, it was a commercial center, but it was also a religious center. And there was there were many temples, and tourists came there, religious tourists, to do the pilgrimages, and then they do a little trading, and it was a busy, hot, you know, Las Vegas-y type of city, cross between Las Vegas and New York. And when Muhammad was about 40 years old, he had a midlife crisis, I guess is what you would think of it as. Things began to trouble him. And he began to go to this cave near Mecca to meditate on why things were the way they were. Why was it that the rich were rich and the poor were poor and forgotten, and you know, widows could be cheated out of their inheritance, and you could be born an orphan and be cheated out of whatever was yours, and people didn't care about you. Whereas out in the desert with the Bedouins, it was a no man left behind kind of ethos there, and people were more equal, and you know, there was just another value system. And so, what could be done about this? And then he had an experience, and the experience is somewhat mysterious. There are several ways that it's recounted, but the general gist of it is that in the dark, in that cave, he suddenly felt himself gripped from behind. His experience of it was that an angel came to visit him, and the angel commanded him to recite, and he said, "I can't recite," and the angel three times commanded him, and then he began to recite. And basically what he recited was the revelation that there's only one God, and that was his revelation. And he went out, and he was scared to talk about it, but eventually he did talk about it. And as, when he did, the people of Mecca, the power brokers of Mecca said, no, if this one God thing takes hold, the business of Mecca is ruined, because we have like 300 idols here, and if there's only one, that'll cut our business down by that amount of that percentage. When I think about that, I smile, because nowadays the single biggest gathering on earth is the one that happens in Mecca every year. There's like 3 million people or something, or I don't know the exact figures, but they all come to Mecca. It's this huge thing. So it turns out one God can pull as many as 300 gods. Anyway, the rich elite of Mecca decided to kill Muhammad, and he had to escape, and he went to Medina. Now, the interesting thing for me about Islamic history is that that move from Mecca to Medina is marked as the beginning of history. That's the year zero. And if you think of Islam purely as a religion, you would suppose that maybe the year zero would either be the moment of revelation, that would be when it began, or it would be the birth of the prophet, or it might be the death of the prophet. So what is it that's so important about a pilgrimage from one city to another? And, you know, you look into it, and you see that the answer is, that was the moment when Muhammad transformed from being a street preacher to being the lead, the everything, the political and every other kind of leader of a community, of a political community. And from then on, his career was devoted to everything that was needed to make this community operate in a certain way. His idea was that the commandments that he was receiving in these revelations, if followed by the people of his community, would enable people to live in harmony and justice, and you know, all the poor would be taken care of, the widows would not be left left behind, and everything would be great. And the people of Mecca came and tried to attack Medina. There was iconic battles. And in the end, all of Arabia became converted to Islam. And at the moment of his death, you know, that was the Islamic community, the Islamic world. It was the whole peninsula of Arabia. And it was, in contrast to previous times, it was at peace. Because, you know, before this community was born into the world, the tribes of Arabia were in a state of constant warfare. And when they entered the Muslim community, the idea was Muslims don't fight with Muslims, so that whatever warfare there was exported to the edges, and the within the Islamic world, which was then just the peninsula of Arabia, within the Islamic world, people were at peace with one another. In the aftermath of Muhammad's death, I think that the Islamic experiment took a very crucial turn. Because the question came up for the community, not just who is our successor, who's the next guy, but what is the next guy? You know, Muhammad himself explicitly said in his last sermon, there will be no more messengers from God. You're not, revelation from God is no longer going to be in the world. And so then what did that mean? And, you know, many Muslims, not all, a few had a different interpretation, but many said, all right, that's it, no more messengers, and now whatever Muhammad revealed evidently is sufficient to run the world on. You know, there was another branch that felt that, no, there's not a messenger, but there's someone with a divinely guided vision, and that we have to find out who that is, and that is the leader. It's not a question of electing someone. It's just a question of discovering who it is. And those people favored the succession of Muhammad's cousin, Ali. But the others said, no, this is a question of codifying the revelations and acting according to them. And the first successors, they had what I think would be, you know, what I can characterize as a very sort of remarkable stance for the leaders of a big and now powerful political community. Their stance was, we don't make any rules. We're not going to decide anything. We are only administrators of the revelation that has already come around. But that raised the question now. Every time there was a decision to be made, people would look in the Quran, what does the Quran say about this? And quite often, it would be difficult to find a ruling in the Quran that applied to any particular situation. So then, the Muslims said, well then, we have to look at other things that Muhammad said and did in his lifetime that were not part of the revelations, and see if there was any situation like this. And what did Muhammad, how did he legislate in that situation? And so then that brought up the enterprise of who remembers everything that Muhammad ever said and did? Well, everyone remembers something. Come on, let's write that down. What do you remember? What do you remember? Then that brought up the question of, wait, what about faulty memory? What about people who are lying? What about people who honestly believe they remember something, but it's this guy remembers one thing and this guy remembers an exactly opposite thing? How do you sort all that out? So then a body of scholarship developed around that, a technique of authentication of the deeds and sayings of Muhammad, and it became a huge part of the enterprise of this Muslim community. I will stop and reiterate that the people in that first community who were living with you know, they were the generation that had known Muhammad personally. They were his companions. And that generation felt about their community that a religious event in the world, and that they had a duty and responsibility to fulfill and complete that religious event. The whole thing was the revelation. The whole operation of this community was the sacred moment. And so it was very important to get this right about how you should live. And so before Islam had a professional army, it had a professional state-supported body of scholars who were paid to record, remember, sift, and evaluate all the different hadith, which are the deeds and sayings of Prophet Muhammad. Then there became a subsidiary level of scholarship, a next level up of scholars who read everything that the scholars had written about everything people could remember about Muhammad's time and evaluated whether they were capable enough scholars and were their judgments correct. And so this huge body of legislation, I'm going to use the word for the moment, then I'll go back and revise it. This huge body of legislation emerged in the first few hundred years of Islamic history, which was not just a legal code, although it did cover, for example, contracts, punishments for crimes, all that kind of thing. But it also covered, how you dress, how you eat, how you sit in a chair, how you just, matters of etiquette, how you treat other human beings, whether you knock on a door three times before you come in or, when can you visit somebody, everything you could imagine in daily life. And there was not a sense of a separation from how you brush your teeth to what is a crime and how do you punish a thief. It was all part of the same architectonic structure of do's, don'ts, ought to's, and maybe you should avoids. So that's one thing that happened in those early years. The other thing that happened, however, is that after the first four successors of Muhammad, who were his close friends and companions and or relatives, the Muslim community went through a convulsion that was very violent, and it was a terrible moment and a traumatic moment in the birth of this community, and the ruler that emerged from it in Muslim history is not thought of as being somebody who has a sacred character, or it's not part of the religious event anymore. Now it was just an empire. These were the Umayyads. Now, in common history, you look at those Umayyads, and it's often characterized as the golden age of Islam, because under those guys, the conquests of Islam took it to its furthest extent. They conquered up into Spain, and they conquered down into what is now Pakistan, and they conquered most of what is now Afghanistan and up into what are these former Soviet republics, Uzbekistan and so on. So they built this huge empire, and in this empire, they still had as a driving sense of what makes history go, the teleological sense. Where is all this going? How is this going to end up? What is the point of all that we're doing? How do we know we're doing the right thing? All of that was still conditioned by the sense of what was happening in the first community, and feeling like the purpose of history is to complete that project, to finally make the world be the Muslim community and to make the Muslim community be the community it was supposed to be originally. Of course, that wasn't the case, because now that it was so successful and it had a big wealthy capital and it supported artists and literati and, they had scientists developing and philosophers but also merchants and traders and everything, there was emerging a group of very rich people. And then, of course, as in every such society, there were the left-behinds, there were the poor, and So this was a circumstance in which insurgents and dissenters and rebels would naturally point back to the stories that came down of the first community. The stories, for example, that Muhammad himself, You know, he never had more than two blankets, and he ate the barley bread for his dinner, and he had no pretensions. And, you know, Hazrat Omar, his second successor, at night he would put a bag of grain on his shoulders, and he would go from house to house. If anyone was poor, they would get the grain from the hands of the Khalifa himself, the head of the community. And the story had it that Muhammad's first successor, Abu Bakr, even though he was the head of a now very large and powerful political community, he milked his neighbor's cow for, you know, to try to get some extra cash. He didn't have, he was not a rich guy. And so all of these kinds of stories proliferate, and they stand in marked contrast to what people see around them. There's aristocrats, usually in this case now, usually Arab aristocrats. You know, they are the ruling class, and other people, other ethnicities like the Persians, are now a second-class citizenry, and there's other people who are poor, and so revolutionary movements develop, whose energy comes from the driving sense of history that you're supposed to make the community happen. After a couple of hundred years of the Umayyads, 150, I guess it was, one of those revolutions topples them, and the Abbasids come in, and they turn out to be more of the Umayyads, only even more so. Even richer, even more powerful, even grander, but also even more an empire that presides over a utter flourishing of science and thought and art and every kind of intellectual achievement. It's in this era that Muslim scientists lay the groundwork for chemistry, you know, mathematics. They develop algebra in this time in the Muslim world. Medicine takes great leaps and bounds. In the city of Baghdad, there are the first really modern hospitals. There's many of them, and they are free to the citizens. It's an amazing idea. We don't have that now. But now dissension, now the empire is so big that it begins to crack. It's just too big. And it ends up that there's three different empires, each of which claims to be the only true caliphate. There's one in Spain, there's one based in Iraq, and there's one based in Cairo. And as time goes on, it begins to sort of decay in every way. I think if you're in the Muslim world and you look back, whatever else you may think about the course of Muslim history from the religious point of view, you look at that empire, the Khalifat, whether ruled by the first successors or the Umayyads or the Abbasids, you look at that Khalifat as the great defining empire of ancient times, in the same way that if you look back from a Western perspective, you see Rome as the great defining empire of ancient times. And just as in Rome, in Rome, part of the thing that happened is that its sheer size and the complexity of ruling so many different people defeated the systems and technology of the time, and different provinces began to become somewhat like independent kingdoms. That happened. And it also happened that what Romans called barbarians, the nomadic Germans in Northern Europe, began to press against the borders and come in. And it also happened that Germans came into the empire and became employees of the emperor. Some of them were the Praetorian Guard, and they supposedly protected the emperor, but then they sometimes killed him and became emperors themselves. So all of that is the story familiar to us about the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. And very much the same story was recapitulated in the Eastern world, in the Middle world. But the barbarians in this case from the north, the nomadic barbarians, were the Turks. And the Turks also were brought into the Muslim world in a characteristic sort of thing that happened in the Islamic world. They were brought in as slaves, and they were raised in military dormitories, and they became the bodyguards and the power elite of the empire, of this core empire. And eventually, in various provinces, they unseated the original guy who had brought them in and took over. You know, I think if you get a slave and raise him as a military specialist in a school and train him to be just the most highly developed fighting and killing machine you can possibly develop, and you're a king, and then you put him outside your bedroom door and say, guard me, you're taking some chances there. And this happened to a lot of these smaller governor kings in the Muslim world. But at the same time, the border became porous, and whole tribes of Turks came pouring in. And, you know, in the Western world, the Germans came pouring in, but by that time, Rome was Christian, and these Germans converted to Christianity. They converted to a sort of a less nuanced version of Christianity, and they were a little more fanatical about their Christianity, and it was a cruder and simpler idea of Christianity, and they set up German Christian kingdoms. So when the Turks came in, the same thing happened. They set up Turkish Muslim kingdoms. They had converted to Islam, and they were not that intellectual, and they were pretty intent on their simple, ready, you know, rough and ready understanding of what Islam was all about. So there we have these parallels between the Western world and the Eastern world. I keep calling it the Eastern world. I want to call it the Middle world because, you know, there is this Middle world and the East is something else. It's further east. And then, you know, by that time, for the people in the Muslim world, Europe was just not of any account. The Muslims themselves were in Europe because Spain was one of the Muslim caliphates. And in the Spanish caliphate, as in the other caliphates, actually, they had a characteristic Muslim idea of how to maintain a multicultural, multi-religious society and keep it harmonious. And that idea, which actually originated in Medina with the original agreement that Muhammad made with the tribes of Medina, that idea was that each community was autonomous in terms of its legal dealings with its own people. And, you know, so the Jews would make the rulings for the Jews, the Christians would make the rulings for the Christians. Everybody lived in the society, and everybody had rights. But the people who were not Muslims had to pay a tax. It was a not being Muslim tax. However, they were exempt from the charity tax, which all Muslims had to pay, zakat. That's one of the duties of Muslims. And then the other thing was only Muslims could be in the military. Other than that, all professions were open to these other religious ethnicities, or religions, religious cultures. And quite often the khalifas of these places and later the sultans of these smaller places had Jewish advisors and Jewish people that were like their prime ministers and so on. And Christians less so, because especially in Spain, the Christians were just much less, that was a society that had fallen to a very primitive level. Rome, which had once been the biggest city in the world, now had like 50,000 inhabitants, while Cordoba in Spain had something like 500,000, and there were many cities of that size. And Baghdad at one time had 1 million, and it was the first city to reach that size. So civilization was in the Muslim world. But now, you know, as the Muslims went along and they were invaded by Turks and the order of the Islamic society broke down. You know, the West was going through a transformation that Muslims didn't even notice. And at the time of when the Turks had really taken over Iran and the Middle East, Europe had become a continent which had finally repelled all invaders, and it had filled up with warriors who were, for complicated reasons, didn't have land and had many reasons to go out and do some conquering for a cause. And so the Crusades began, and the Europeans came and they set up three little kingdoms in the Muslim world along the Mediterranean. And in many views of history, that was a seminal moment in the interaction between the Muslim world and the Western world. But actually, you know, from the Muslim point of view, I find, you know, that the Crusades were relatively a minor event for the Muslims. For one thing, the Muslims did not experience that as anything like a clash of civilizations. They didn't see the knights coming out of the primeval forests of Europe as being a civilization. They didn't think there was an intellectual or religious issue involved. They were just a catastrophe, and they came in and destroyed stuff. And originally, when they first came in, the Middle East was divided up into lots of little Turkish-ruled kingdoms, and the Turks that were kings of these places were mostly cousins of each other, and they were fiercely competitive with each other. And for 50 to 100 years, the Turkish kings mainly saw the Crusaders as people they could use to weaken another Turkish king. So they were fighting, but they were manipulating the Crusaders saying, "Come, now you go fight that guy over there." And the Crusaders never got further into the Muslim world than that. The real catastrophe for the Muslim world came a little bit later, starting around 12, middle first 25 years of the 1200s. It came from the north, it came from the Mongols. And when the Mongols came sweeping down, they destroyed whole cities. There's a city in Afghanistan called Shor-e-Ghulghula, the city of howling, and it's just a pile of rubble. And it's one of the places where when the Mongols came, they killed everything down to the dogs and cats. And they did that in Herat, and they did that in Naishapur, I think. They did that in many other cities. They didn't do it to all cities, however, because it was a particular tactic. It was let's go to a city, take no prisoners, and just let a few people escape so that when the word spreads that this is how we operate, when we come to a city, they'll open their gates and let us in. And by the time the Mongols were done, I'm going to backtrack here a little bit. I'm going to say that, you know, the success of the Muslim community was its religious proof. In the early iconic battles of Islam, it was a regular fact that some number of Muslims would find themselves in battle with about three times that many somebody else, and then they would win the battle. And so a repetition of this again and again nourished the idea that the proof of the revelation is the military and political success of the community. And that had become an element of theology. So now when the Muslim world is destroyed by these Mongols who are completely not Muslims at all, the question comes up, if success is the proof that we're right, what does this kind of defeat mean? How are we to interpret this religiously? The Mongol invasion was a catastrophe for many people living in these cities, but it was also a huge kind of conundrum for Muslim theologians. And in that period, some of these theologians picked up on the idea that the reason that the Mongols succeeded so mightily against the Muslims was not because there was anything wrong with Islam, but because Muslims had stopped being Muslims. It was because of the failures of Muslims to behave as they were instructed to behave by the revelations that accounted for their weakness. And, you know, at the time, that ideology did not immediately spread, and it wasn't taken up by every theologian. And it wasn't because the Muslim world rapidly recovered from the Mongol invasion. Very soon, there was the Ottoman Empire, the Safavid Empire, the Mughal Empire, three big rich empires that emerged from the ruins of the Muslim world. The places where the Mongols ruled in the Islamic world, they converted and became Muslims within about two or three generations. So actually, Islam reemerged and everything was fine, and Islam was back on course. And then this period happened when these rich civilizations of the Islamic world were fat and happy. You know, they were as rich as could be. And within the Muslim world, they felt like that is the world. And they didn't have hardly any travelers went west into Europe. What's to see in Europe? Nothing, no reason to go there. You know, there was many Muslim travelers. It was a thing that Muslims did. They traveled from Morocco to India to, you know, it's like there were so many thousands of miles to travel. You didn't need to go to Europe. But unbeknownst to the Muslims, the Europeans now had actually gone into a new phase. They had, you know, gone through the Reformation, the Scientific Revolution, and the Capitalist Revolution, and they had begun to form into nation states, which is a very powerful form of organization. And so, starting 1500, 1600, in that period, from the European world, little ships began arriving in the powerful Muslim places. And they landed and they said, hey, could we set up a little trading post here? So I'm telling you that this beginning of the permeation of the West into the East did not come as a military thing. It wasn't a clash of civilizations. It wasn't a conquest. They just arrived as businessmen. And these businessmen were not just any old businessmen. They worked for corporations, the first corporations that formed. The East Indies Company, the Dutch Indies Company, and France had its own. These were joint stock companies that had a different form of organizing than businesses of earlier times. And at first, the Muslims paid really no attention to them. You know, they just sat there and when they fought each other mostly. In India, the French and the English fought some wars, and they finally the English won and the French won someplace else, and so things just went along, and a couple of centuries passed, and Muslims looked around, and all of a sudden they realized that somehow or other they were not masters in their own house anymore. By the time you get to 750, 1800, it was very plausible to be a Muslim living in Egypt and discover that there is a private club you can't join because you're Egyptian. You know, it was very plausible to be in India and find places you can't enter because you're Indian. You know, in Algeria, you want to start a business, but you have to go and ask a French guy for permission. And it was sort of mysterious, I think, to many Muslims as to how did this happen? When was the big fight? I don't remember being conquered, and yet here we are, completely conquered. Now, as it happens, I think the evolution of Islam as a religion had also proceeded at this point to a level of incrustation that made the Islamic world ripe for a reformation-like renewal of some sort, because this process of filling in every detail of life from the largest to the smallest with a scholarship-derived prescription that told every person what to do in every possible instance started to not feel like religion to a lot of people. And it aroused a desire for some kind of renewal. And if there had been no permeation of the Islamic world by the Western world, and this political fact had not been present in people's lives, then there may have been a reformation of some kind in Islam that was quite different from what actually happened. But what actually happened is that the question of how to renew the religion could not be extricated from the question of why had history stopped going in the direction that it was supposed to go? Why was it not proceeding in the direction of someday the whole world will belong to the Muslim community and we will have perfected it and everything will be harmonious and just across the entire globe as it was in Medina in the 7th century? That seems to have completely stopped. And now people look back and said, hey, there's a guy who explained this already. It was after the Mongols. Ibn Taymiyyah was a great scholar from that time, and, you know, he developed this whole idea that Muslims stop being Muslims. That's the problem. So in the next century, from 1750 to 1850, let's say, I would say that there were three different kinds of responses to the reformation of Islam, the renewal of Islam, and the political question of why the Muslim world was weak. I'm saying it as three things, but I think in the Muslim world they were all the same thing. And one extreme of that was to embrace the Ibn Taymiyyah view that we have to go back, we have to discover how they lived in the original community, and we have to live exactly that way. And Ibn Wahhab was a preacher in Arabia, and he sort of developed that doctrine to its most developed extent. Another extreme said, actually, maybe we made some mistakes here. Actually, maybe, you know, we've gotten sidetracked into a superstitious and fairy tale ridden interpretation of our religion. Maybe we need to reinterpret Islam in a modernist way and see it as an ethical system, clean away the superstitious elements, the idea of sort of the magical kind of ideas that have crept in, and we have to separate the religion from the state like they do in Europe because it's working for them, and make a religion a private matter and then have the state have its own rules. We're not gonna run the society by the Sharia. Let's do like they do in Europe. They're right, actually. And then there was another idea that was sort of situated between these two extremes. And the great proponent of this idea was a guy I think is one of the most interesting characters in history. His name is Syed Jamaluddin Afghan. Obviously, I partly like him because his name was, you know, the Afghan, and we in Afghanistan are proud that this guy emerged from our country. But his Afghanness is actually a point of contention. The Iranians say he was actually an Iranian, and he said he was Afghan because he wanted people not to know. So I don't know. I'm representing that point of view in a biased way, perhaps. But Syed Jamaluddin Afghan said what Muslims have done is the opposite of what they should do. They have rejected Western science and they've embraced Western social values. Actually, we have to do the opposite of that. We have to reject Western social values and embrace Western science. And he was a modernist in the sense that he said Islam is a scientific ideology. Islam doesn't have in its origins miracles that defy nature as the proof of the religion, and it doesn't. You know, it doesn't have any water turning into wine. Muhammad didn't raise the dead to walk. There was none of that. There was just the political success of the community and the fact of the revelation of the Quran. That was supposed to be the miracle. So this guy said, you know, Islam is in its essence a rationalist idea, and there's no reason why we can't prosper and be competitive with the West. He also said, and this is, I think, the idea that has a lot of resonance or a lot of implications for modern times. He said there's not a bunch of different struggles going on in the world. It's not the British against the Indians. It's not the Iranians keeping out the Russians and the British. It's not the Algerians and the French. It's not the Egyptians and some other European power. It's not all these little things. There's actually only two things. There's the Islamic world and there's the West. And it's all one struggle. And all Islamic political entities are part of the same political entity. We should be pan-Islamists, and we should find our strength in dissolving all the borders and being one new community. This guy never had a political party. He never had a political office. He really didn't write a book. You know, he didn't leave behind any tracts or doctrines, formal doctrines. He just traveled, and he spent his first bit of his career in Afghanistan, and there he completely supported a strong central government because Afghanistan was all torn to pieces with tribal warfare. There he wanted the central government. Then he went to, and he got in trouble there and they kicked him out. Then he went to Turkey. And in Turkey, Turkey was, Ottoman Empire. It had a strong central government. And it was very, the scholars of Islam were very much in power there. And there, his big point was the scholars are dummies. Stop listening to scholars. Think for yourself. And the scholars got mad and kicked him out. And the king of Egypt said, "Come here, we like you. Come here." He was in a struggle with his own scholars, and so Jamaluddin went to Egypt. But there, instead of attacking scholars, he attacked the idea of royal dynasties, and he said, "Get rid of these kings. Islam is a inherently democratic ideology. Let's set up a parliament." So he got kicked out of there. Then he went to the West for a while, and he published a journal from Paris. Then he went back to Iran, and he launched a movement to boycott European products. It was the first of those kinds of boycotts that now have become a standard political practice. And his boycott was aimed at tobacco. All tobacco production, sales, and every other marketing and everything, that contract had been signed away as a whole by the royal family of Iran to Britain. And, Iran was doing that with everything that it had at that point. They signed away their oil a little bit later. They signed away their banking. They just gave big chunks of their economy away to European powers in exchange for some amount of money, which went directly to the royal family. So this was a corrupt system, and when he got to Iran, he yelled and screamed about that, and in fact, he started a constitutional movement that ended up toppling the Qajars. But by then, he had been expelled. He went to Turkey, and he finally died there. Not even finally. I think he was 58 when he died, so he didn't have a long career. But all he did was just go around as a single person. And everywhere he went, he left revolution and upheaval and new ideas and, questions and answers and remarkable kinds of prairie fires that he started. And in Afghanistan, where he had started out and where he had been the tutor of the royal princes, a modernist movement started there, which eventually bloomed with his followers in the revolutionary movement that finally did definitively kick the British out of Afghanistan. And then that revolutionary king then launched a series of totally progressive radical reforms in Afghanistan that included constitution, women's rights, education both for boys and girls, all this kind of stuff. 10 years, and then there was a backlash, and it all fell apart. So there's these three movements, and the Wahhabi movement quickly found an alliance with an actual political power. Ibn Wahhab became the ally of Ibn Saud, who was a tribal leader, and the two of them together turned into a formidable force. And not just that, but those two families married into each other's tribes, so that by now there is a real sort of genealogical association with Wahhabism as a doctrine and the Saudi family as a political power. And they emerged, they were crushed, they lay low, but eventually they reemerged and founded modern Saudi Arabia, and that's the Wahhabi movement. Versions of Wahhabism also then spread to India, and that just became something that was all over the Muslim world. But at the other pole, the people who said Europe is right, let's turn Islam into an ethical doctrine, etc., etc., which included, for most of those guys, Let's stop wearing these baggy trousers or these long dresses or whatever we've been wearing. Let's get rid of the turbans. Those are so old-fashioned. Let's wear hats. Let's wear suits. Let's pass laws against having beards, this kind of thing. People who subscribe to that idea of Islamic reform were certainly able to communicate and talk with the Western imperialists who were in their countries. They spoke the same language. And even though many of those people became stout nationalist revolutionaries, the alliance, the mutual aid that those elites gave to the imperialists and vice versa made them the ruling elite throughout the Muslim world. In Egypt, in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, the modernists, the secular modernists, were the ruling elite. And virtually in all of those places, they set to work on a crash course of development because they all kind of saw, we don't have factories, we don't have railroads, we don't have electric lights, we don't have this and that. Let's build that stuff as fast as we can. And in all of those societies, because of the way they were structured, all the development kind of had a way of seeping upwards. And then down at the bottom, there were people who were not only left behind economically, but they were sort of outside the national economies. They were in the old traditional economy. They were villagers. They were the working poor in the cities. And amongst them, the other kinds of revolutionary doctrines about Wahhabism and the original community and how everything was just there and, tear down, eat the rich kind of doctrine, it had a strong hold. And that brings us kind of to the present day because I would say that if the secular modernists of the Muslim world had been able to and had found some way to actually democratize their countries and actually share the wealth with their people, they'd still be in power, but they completely signally failed to do that, and therefore the revolutionary movements emerged from the bottom, and in one case after another, it toppled them. I will just add finally that, in many of these places, there were, in a certain period, there was communist revolutionaries who thought they might be able to organize because they saw the same kind of dispossession and misery that for communist ideologues also spelled, these guys have a legitimate grievance against the rich. We should be able to organize them. And they didn't succeed because they did not have a mythology that resonated for people. And when jihadist Islamists came, they did have a mythology that resonated with people. They were able to paint images and hark back to a mythical time that people learned at their parents' and grandparents' knees growing up. And so they were very successful, and some of these revolutionary movements have come out of that, and I'm going to stop there.
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Tamim Ansari, author of The Widow's Husband, West of Kabul, and Destiny Interrupted, World History Through Islamic Eyes. He spoke on the topic, Through Islamic Eyes, A Parallel History of the World. Mr. Ansari's appearance was co-sponsored by the Henry W. Kasper S.J. Professorship in History and the Creighton University Muslim Student Association. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday evening, April 8, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.